You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collected work of Rudolf Steiner called the Bhagavad Gita in the West, composed of two lecture cycles. This is the second lecture cycle, entitled The Occult Significance of the Bhagavad Gita. Lecture 5, however, in this file, this would be Lecture 10 in this whole collection, given in Helsinki on June 1st, 1913. If we wish to penetrate into the mysteries of human life, we must fix our attention on a great law of existence, what is called the cyclic law. As a rule, it is better to characterize and describe than to define. In this case also, I prefer not to use a definition of what is meant here by the cyclical course of life, for by comparison with actual reality, definitions must always appear insubstantial. A Greek philosophical school, wishing to gain insight into the nature of definitions, once set out to give a definition of the human being. As you know, definitions are intended to provide concepts corresponding to experienced phenomena. But those who have logical insight cannot help feeling the poverty and unfruitfulness of this process. The members of the Greek school eventually agreed to define the human being as a featherless biped. Footnote. In an effort to formulate an adequate definition of the human being, Plato dialogically defined man as a featherless biped animal. Subsequently, Diogenes, the cynic, presented a plucked chicken with the remark, "Here is Plato's human being." Close quote. End of footnote. While this particular definition sounds rather like a silly epigram, it does represent human nature in certain respects. The next day, one of the members of this school brought in a plucked hen and said to the company, "According to your definition, this is a human being." A silly way to show the unreality of attempts to define things. Being concerned with realities, we will proceed then to describe things and their essential characteristics. To begin, we will consider a cyclic familiar in everyday life that, we will consider a cycle familiar in everyday life, that of our waking and sleeping. What does it really signify? We can only understand the nature of sleep if we realize that in the present epoch, the sole activity of human waking life brings about a continual destruction of delicate structures in the nervous system. With our every thought and every impulse of will arising in us under the stimulus of the outside world, we are destroying delicate forms in our brain. In the near future, it will more and more be realized how sleep must supplement our waking day life. We are approaching the point where natural science will join with spiritual science in these matters. Natural science has already produced more than one theory to the effect that our waking life operates in a kind of destructive way in the nerves and brain. Owing to this fact, we have to allow the corresponding reverse process, the compensation, to take place during sleep. While we are asleep, forces of which we remain unconscious are at work in us that do not otherwise manifest themselves. They are busy reconstructing the finer nerve structures of our brain. Now, it is this very destruction that enables us to have processes of thought and to acquire knowledge. Ordinary knowledge would not be possible if processes of disintegration did not take place in us during our waking hours. Two opposite processes are at work in our nervous system. While we are awake, a process of destruction, and during sleep, a repairing process. Since it is to the destructive process that we owe our consciousness, it is that process we perceive. Our waking life consists in perceiving disintegrating processes. When we sleep, we are not conscious because no destructive process is at work in us. The force that at other times creates our consciousness is used up in constructive work while we sleep. There you have a cycle. Let us now consider what happens during sleep. Because of this alternating cycle of build-up and break-down processes, we see why it is so dangerous to health to go without proper sleep. Certainly, human life is so arranged that the danger is not immediately apparent, because what is present in us at any one time has been built up for a considerable time before. Abnormal processes cannot affect our nature as deeply as we might imagine. We could expect people who suffer from sleeplessness to go to pieces quickly, but they do not. The reason for this is the same as that which holds for people both blind and deaf, like the famous Helen Keller, whose intellect could nevertheless be developed. In the present age, this should theoretically be possible, for what constitutes the greater part of our intelligence enters the brain through eyes and ears. The reason for Miss Keller's intellectual development is that though the portals of her senses are closed, she has inherited a brain that has the potential for development. If humans were not hereditary beings, a case like hers would be impossible. Which is to say, if humans did not have a much healthier brain through heredity than we generally give them credit for, sleeplessness would in a very short time completely undermine health. But most people have so much inherited strength that insomnia can persist for a long time without seriously injuring them. Nevertheless, the cycle of construction takes place, with its resulting unconsciousness in sleep and destruction accompanying consciousness in waking life. In the totality of human life, we perceive not only these smaller cycles, but larger ones as well. Here I will call your attention to a cycle I have often mentioned before. Anyone who follows the course of life in the Western world will observe a quite definite configuration of the spiritual life of humankind in the period from the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries to the last third of the 19th. In ordinary life, these developments are observed vaguely and even inaccurately. But if we examine them in sufficient depth, we shall see how, since the last third of the 19th century, there have been in all directions signs of an altogether different form of Western spiritual life. Of course, we are at the beginning of this new trend, so people do not notice it in its full significance. Just imagine someone trying to speak before an audience such as this, for instance in the 1840s or 50s, about the same things I am putting before you here. It is unthinkable, absurd. It would have been out of the question to speak of these things as we do now, at any rate from the 14th century to the last third of the 19th. This was the period when the natural scientific mode of thought, the way of thinking that produced the great materialistic achievements, reached its height. The stragglers of scientific intellectualism will go on adhering to it for some time to come, but the actual epoch of materialism is past. Just as the era of scientific thought began around the 15th century, so the era of spiritual thought is now beginning. These two sharply differentiated epochs meet in the very time in which we are living. It will become more and more evident that the new mode of thought must get in touch with the reality of things. Thought will become very different from the thought of the last four centuries, though the latter had to be so in its time. During this period, humanity's gaze had to be directed outward into the far spaces of the universe. I have often spoken of the great significance for Western spiritual evolution, of the moment when Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and Giordano Bruno together burst open the blue vault of heaven. Until their time, it was believed that the blue cup of the heavens was suspended over our earth. These great thinkers declared that this hollow cup did not really exist. They taught humankind to look out into the infinite distances of cosmic space. Now, what was it that was so significant about Bruno's deed in explaining to humanity how the blue sphere they had set as the boundary of their power of sight was not really there, and that, quote, "you have only to realize that it is you yourselves who project it out into space," Close quote. It marked the beginning of an epoch that came to an end with the discovery that the spectroscope allowed one to investigate the material composition of the farthest heavenly bodies. A marvelous epoch, this epoch of materialism. Now we are at the starting point of another epoch, one that, though it has its origin in the same laws of growth as the preceding one, will be the epoch of spirituality. Just as the epoch of natural science was prepared by Bruno's work in breaking through the limits of space, so will the firmament of time be broken through in the age now beginning. Humankind, imagining life to be enclosed between birth and death or conception and death, will learn that these are merely boundaries set by the human soul itself. Just as in earlier times, humans had set as the boundary of their senses a blue sphere above them, and then suddenly their vision expanded into the infinite spheres of space, so will the boundaries of time, of birth and death, be broken through. Set free of these, there will lie before our gaze in the infinite sea of time all the changes in the kernel of the human being as we follow it through its repeated incarnations. Thus a new age is beginning, the age of spiritual thought. Now, if we can recognize the esoteric basis of these transitions from one age to another, where shall we see the cause of this change in human thought? It is not anything that philosophy or external physiology or anatomy can detect on its own. Yet forces have entered the active human soul and are being used today to gather spiritual knowledge. The same forces that have been working during the last four centuries as constructive energies in the human organism. These mysterious forces worked just as constructive forces work in the nervous system during sleep, throughout the period from Copernicus to the last third of the 19th century. These forces were building up a definite structure in certain parts of the brain. The brains of Westerners are different from what they were five centuries ago. What is under our skulls today does not have the same appearance as it had then. Even though this cannot be proved externally, under the human forehead a delicate organ has developed, and the forces building it have now fulfilled their task. In the next cycle of history now approaching, it will become evident in more and more people. Now that it is there, the forces that built it are liberated, and Western humanity can use them to gain spiritual knowledge. Here we have the esoteric physiological foundation of the matter. Already we are beginning to work with the forces that humans could not use during the last 400 years, because they were spent in building up the organ needed to allow spiritual knowledge to take its place in the world. Let us imagine a man of the 17th or 18th century. As he stands there before us, we know that certain esoteric forces are at work behind his forehead, transforming his brain. These forces were perpetually at work in all the people of the West. Now, let us assume that this man had managed to suspend these forces for a moment, made them cease their work. The same thing would have happened to him as it did happen in certain cases, as takes place when in the middle of sleep one suspends the forces that ordinarily work at building up the nerve structures of the brain and lets them run loose. It is possible to experience moments when we seem to awaken in sleep, and yet do not awaken, for we remain motionless, we cannot move our limbs, we have no external perception, but we are awake. In the moments of free play of those regenerating forces, we can use them for clairvoyant vision, we can see into the spiritual worlds. A similar thing happened if a man 200 years ago suspended the constructive activity of his brain. He allowed these forces to remain inactive for a moment and became, briefly, clairvoyant. What did he see? What did he perceive? He saw the forces working into the brain from the spiritual world. the forces that were preparing human beings from around the 15th century to the 19th century, so that from the 20th century onward, humans might rise to spiritual vision. There were always isolated individuals who had such experiences. Experiences of truly momentous force, indescribably impressive. There were always people who for brief moments lived in the supersensible forces working to bring forth in the sense world what did not exist in former cycles of evolution, the finer organ in the frontal cavity. Such individuals saw the gods. They saw spiritual beings at work in the whole building process of the human organism. In this we see clairvoyance described from a fresh aspect. We can bring about such moments during sleep by practicing the exercises I have given in my book titled How to Know Higher Worlds, and thereby gain glimpses of spiritual life such as are described in my book titled A Way of Self-Knowledge. It is possible during a given cycle of evolution for the forces at work preparing the future to become free for a moment and become clairvoyantly visible. We may also call it by another name and designate as the forces of Gabriel these forces working at the subtle reconstruction of the human brain structure. We say Gabriel, but the point is to gain a brief insight into the supersensible, where we perceive a spiritual being working from those worlds into the human organism. We perceive a sum of forces, in fact, directed by a being, Gabriel, of the hierarchy of the Archangeloi. From the 15th century to the last third of the 19th century, the Gabrielic force was at work on the human physical organism. And because of this, the power to understand the spiritual world was dormant for a while. It was this dormancy of spiritual understanding that brought forth the great triumphs of natural science. Now this force has reawakened. The spirit has done its work. We stand at the beginning of a spiritual age. The Gabrielic forces have been liberated. We can now use them, for they have become forces for the soul. Here we have a cycle of somewhat greater significance than that of waking and sleeping. There are, however, even mightier cycles in human evolution. We may note how self-consciousness, the pride of humankind in this era of our post-Atlantean age, was not always there, but had to be developed gradually. Today, the word evolution is often heard, but people seldom take it in real earnest. Occasionally, very curious experiences show how naive people can be in regard to the world surrounding them. For in their naivete, people allow all kinds of things to emerge from the subconscious, but find it hard to resolve, to really attribute a supersensible origin to what enters their known world from the unknown. In the last few days, I have again come across a curious instance of this logic that stops halfway. We can well understand why the anthroposophical outlook meets with so much resistance when we bear in mind that it takes a particular habit of thought to understand anthroposophy, namely, the habit of any line of thinking. I have here a title, Freethinker's Calendar, published in Germany. The first edition came out last year. In it, a perfectly sincere person attacks the custom of teaching children religious ideas. He points out that this is contrary to the child's nature, since he himself has observed that when children are allowed to grow up on their own, they develop no religious ideas. It is therefore unnatural to inculcate these ideas into children. Now we can be certain that this calendar will reach hundreds of people, who will henceforth imagine that they understand how senseless it is to teach children religion. There are many such arguments today, and people never notice their complete lack of logic. In reply, we need only ask, quote, if children for some reason have lived all their lives on an island alone and have not learned to speak, ought we, therefore, to refrain from teaching them to speak? Close quote. That would be the same kind of logic. Of course, people will not admit it is the same, since they found it so profound in the first instance. It is curious to observe on the broad horizon of external life today things that represent some after-effect of the passing materialist age. I have yet another example. Some remarkable essays recently published by Woodrow Wilson, President of the United States of America. There is one on the laws of human progress. He points out that people are influenced by the dominant thought of their age, so that, for example, in Newton's time, when everything was permeated with the idea of gravity, the effects of Newton's theories could be felt in social concepts, even in political terminology, though actually these theories are only applicable to the heavenly bodies. The idea of gravity was especially influential. All this is true. We need only read the literature of Newton's time to find everywhere words like attraction and repulsion. Wilson develops this point very ingeniously. He says how unsatisfactory it is to apply purely mechanical concepts, as of celestial mechanism, to human life and conditions. He shows how these ideas were completely embedded in human life at that time, and how widely they influenced political and social affairs. He rightly denounces this application of purely mechanical laws in an age when Newtonism drew all thought under its yoke. Quote, "We must think along different lines," says Wilson, and then he proceeds to construct his own concept of the state. Now, the way he does it is that after all he has said about Newtonism, he himself allows Darwinism to speak through every page of his writing. In fact, he is naive enough to admit it. He says that Newtonian concepts were insufficient. We must apply the Darwinian laws of the organism. Here we have a living instance of the way people march through the world today with half-baked logic, because in reality the laws derived purely from the living organism are also insufficient. We need laws of the soul and spirit. Thus we understand how objections are piled up against anthroposophical thought, for it requires an all-pervading thinking, a logic that penetrates to the core and does not stop halfway. This is just the virtue of the anthroposophical outlook. It forces its followers to think in an orderly manner. So we must think of evolution in the spiritual sense, not in Wilson's Darwinian sense. We must bear in mind that the self-consciousness that is the essential characteristic of today's humanity, this firm rooting in the ego, has only gradually developed. It too needed to be prepared, just as our spiritual thinking was being prepared in the last four centuries. Spiritual forces had to work down from the supersensible worlds in order to develop what later found expression in the self-conscious life of humans. In this connection, we can speak of a break in evolution with a preceding and a succeeding epoch. We will call the latter the age of self-consciousness. Footnote, in many of his books and lectures, Steiner gives the dates of these ages, each approximately 2100 years, as follows. Sentient soul age, 3rd millennium to mid-8th century BCE. Intellectual soul age, mid-8th century to 1413. Consciousness soul age, 1413 to the mid-4th millennium. End of footnote. This period, the consciousness soul age, end of footnote, is preceded in the cyclic interchange by one, that is the intellectual soul age, in which the organ of self-consciousness was being built into the human being from the supersensible worlds. What now works as a soul force in self-consciousness was then working unrecognizably in the depths of human nature. The junction of these two great epochs is an important point in evolution. Before this time, most people had no self-consciousness at all. Even in the most advanced, it was comparatively weak. People then did not think as they do today, with the awareness, quote, I am thinking this thought. Their thoughts rose up like living dreams. Nor did their impulses of will and feeling enter their consciousness as they do today. They lived more of an instinctive life in their souls. From the spiritual worlds, however, beings were working into the human organism, preparing it for a later time, when it would be capable of self-consciousness. Meanwhile, people had to live quite differently then, even as external experience is quite different from the 15th and 20th centuries CE, from what it will become later on. So we must say that until the period when self-consciousness entered the human soul, everything that could prepare the way for it had been flowing into human life. Now, let us imagine that toward the end of that ancient epoch, a mighty shock in one man's life suddenly cut off all that was binding him to the forces I just described, the forces of an earlier epoch, suspending their action for a moment. He would have experienced what we experience when in sleep we temporarily withdraw from the constructive forces and become clairvoyant. What an 18th century person would have experienced in suspending the forces then at work on his or her brain structure. If in that ancient time one withheld one's understanding and feeling for the sacrificial fires and reverence for the ancestors, one could for a moment use the forces normally used by understanding and gaze into the supersensible worlds. One could then see how human self-consciousness was being prepared from the spiritual world. This is what Arjuna did when, at the moment of battle, he experienced such a shock. The usually constructive forces stood still in him, and he could look upward to the divine being preparing the way for self-consciousness. This divinity was Krishna. In the region where self-consciousness first makes its appearance, people were strictly divided into castes. They respected this division. Those born in lower castes felt it as their highest endeavor to order their lives within their castes, so that in later incarnations they might raise themselves to higher ones. It was a mighty driving force in the evolution of the human soul. People knew that by developing their soul forces, they were making themselves fit to rise for their next life in a higher caste. So, too, they looked up to their ancestors, seeing in them something that is not bound to one particular body. People honored the ancestors because they had died, leaving behind the manes, the spiritual quality working after death from the higher spheres. Seeing in the cult of the ancestors something that is already present in us, unbound to the physical body, the self-conscious soul that goes through the gates of death into the spiritual world was good preparation for the great goal of human nature. For 400 years, the best education in spirituality had been one that forced humans to think in natural scientific terms. Similarly, in ancient times, installation of the respect for caste was a wonderful preparation for the development of self-consciousness. Each person stood within a caste and developed a very special connection to the caste system. The pious reverence for ancestors and caste was an extraordinarily active force working deep into human life. Spiritual beings were at work, preparing for a future when a person would be able to feel with every thought, I think, with every feeling, I feel, with every impulse of will, I will. Krishna, then, is that being who has worked through centuries, from the 7th and 8th centuries BCE onward, on the human organism, to make humans capable of gradually entering the epoch of self-consciousness. What kind of impression does he make, this master builder of the human ego nature? He must speak to Arjuna in words saturated through and through with self-consciousness. Thus, from another side, we understand Krishna as the divine architect of what prepared and brought about self-consciousness in humanity. The Bhagavad Gita tells us how, in particular circumstances, a man could come into the presence of this divine builder of his nature. There we have one aspect of Krishna's nature. In the succeeding lectures, we shall learn to know yet another aspect. The end of Lecture 10.